It is the 19th of June, 1940. Prime Minister Winston Churchill sits alone in his office, surrounded by documents, maps, and correspondence. His aides on the other side of the door can hear an occasional grumble from their irritable leader. The Allied forces of France and the United Kingdom are still smarting from being tossed out of France unceremoniously by the Germans. The miracle of Dunkirk saved hundreds of thousands of lives, but, wondered Churchill, what now? The French army had fallen to the Germans. Nazis now strolled through Paris, and Italy had officially joined the war on the side of Germany. England, he thought, stands alone. At this very moment, a British delegation was in France discussing the fate of the French naval fleet. Leader of the House of Lords and Secretary of State for the Colonies, Lord George Lloyd, Admiral Sir Dudley Pound, and Albert Alexander, the First Lord of the Admiralty, are to convince the French leaders to move their fleets to British ports. Churchill feared the formidable French navy would fall into German or Italian hands, and he simply could not allow this to happen. France's de facto leader, Marshal Philippe Pétain, and Minister of Marine, Admiral François Darlan, had rejected previous requests, saying it would leave France utterly defenseless. Alexander proposes the fleet to be sent to ports in the United States for the duration of the war. Admiral Darlan won't hear of it. Darlan replies, "Marshal Pétain has given the British government his soldiers' word that he will not surrender a single unit of the French fleet to the foes of Great Britain. You also have my word. Is that not a sufficient guarantee for you?" Alexander replies, "We have no use for words." Marshal Pétain rises from the table and leaves the room. This was the last meeting between England and France as allies. The Royal Navy's World War II assault on the French fleet, today on Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs. Hello, and welcome to Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs, Tales of Mishaps, Misfortune, and Misadventure. The battles between the British Royal Navy and the French Navy under the Vichy government that occurred during World War II are often overlooked. When we think of Europe during World War II, images of the German Blitzkrieg battling the determined Allied forces comes to mind. There are countless books and films about events such as the evacuation of Dunkirk, the costly Battle of the Atlantic, the Battle of the Bulge, and the terrifying threat of German bombs during the Battle of Britain. The Allied invasion of Normandy on June 6, 1944, codenamed Operation Overlord, is still the largest amphibious invasion in history. France would ultimately be liberated, and Charles de Gaulle was paraded through the streets of Paris as a returning hero. The United Kingdom and France began as allies against Nazi Germany, but starting in July of 1940, these former allies, or at least a portion of them, became bitter enemies. Between the 26th of May and 4th of June 1940, Operation Dynamo saw the miraculous evacuation of British and French troops from Dunkirk. In just 6 weeks, the German army, the Wehrmacht, had plowed through the Netherlands, Belgium, and Luxembourg and stormed into northern France. German Panzer Corps had completely surrounded the British Expeditionary Force and French Army at Dunkirk. But strangely, the German assault was ordered to halt by Adolf Hitler. There is much debate over why Hitler ordered this halt, but nevertheless, it gave the British an opportunity to launch Operation Dynamo. This was an amphibious rescue mission coordinated by Vice Admiral Bertram Ramsay from the tunnels beneath Dover Castle, the scale of which had never been seen before. The beaches and harbor at Dunkirk were rendered unusable by German bombing, preventing large vessels from getting close to the shore. Instead, a vast armada of 933 ships was mustered, including over 700 small commercial and private vessels. These lifeboats, barges, Fishing vessels, yachts, and pleasure boats were small enough to get to the beaches and rescue small numbers of men at a time and take them to offshore transport ships. About one-third of the 338,226 men were rescued by these smaller vessels. The remaining men lined up on two long jetties called moles, where they could board larger ships. Of the rescued troops, 59% were British, 39% French, and 2% other Allied troops. The French troops who were evacuated or otherwise managed to escape became known as the Free French. The British Expeditionary Force was pushed out of mainland Europe and thrown back to their home island. The French army was shattered. It was a devastating defeat for the Allies. Before evacuating, Allied military assets were destroyed to keep them out of German hands. However, the miracle of Dunkirk saved the bulk of the experienced and trained troops. Had they been killed or captured, there may not have been any chance but to sue for peace with Adolf Hitler. But the successful evacuation gave the Allies a chance to regroup, recover, and live to fight another day. Following the successful but somber event, Winston Churchill stated, "We must be very careful not to assign to this deliverance the attributes of a victory. Wars are not won by evacuations." By the 4th of June 1940, France, and much of Western Europe for that matter, was under German control. To make matters worse, Italy joined the war on the side of Germany on the 10th of June, prompting many French leaders to ask Prime Minister Paul Reynaud to seek an armistice. That same day, Reynaud and General Charles de Gaulle left Paris for Tours, and the rest of the government followed the next day. Reynaud refused to pursue an armistice, and a strong opposition formed against him under the leadership of Henri-Philippe Pétain. Pétain was the Marshal of France, a well-respected veteran, and hero of World War I, nicknamed the Victor of Verdun. French ministers continued to push for an armistice with Germany, and on the 13th of June, Reynaud asked to be released from the pact he signed with the former British Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, so that France might pursue an armistice with Germany. Winston Churchill, the new Prime Minister, did not agree and urged Reynaud to fight on. During these talks on the 14th of June, German forces rolled through the streets of Paris as locals looked on nervously. Germany now occupied all of northern France, and 8 million French relocated to the south of France, believing Pétain would protect them. But the Marshal had virtually no army left to command, and the growing discontent and uncertainty among the French people was palpable. Of the situation, Pétain said, "We have lost faith in our destiny. We are like mariners without a pilot." On June 15th, French ministers voted to ask Germany for terms of an armistice. The following day, Reynaud received a letter from Churchill, agreeing to allow France to seek an armistice, but with the condition that the French naval fleet be moved to British ports. French Admiral and Minister of Marine François Darlan rejected the proposal, saying it would leave France defenseless. In a last, desperate move, the British cabinet proposed an official union of England and France to continue to fight as one nation. But this did not come to pass. Paul Reynaud resigned as prime minister that same day, and the French ministers requested terms for an armistice from Germany. Former Prime Minister Paul Reynaud attempted to flee France for North Africa, but was hospitalized following an automobile accident, which killed his mistress, Hélène Desportes. Pétain had him arrested, and Reynaud spent the remainder of the war in French, German, and Austrian prisons. Pétain supported the armistice with Germany, and the meeting with German officials took place at the location where the armistice of 1918 was signed, in the Compiègne Forest, in the very same spot, in the very same train car, where Germany capitulated. Hitler, and most Germans, believed the 1918 armistice was shameful and an embarrassment for Germany. This was Hitler's revenge. The head of the German delegation, General Wilhelm Keitel, presented the terms of the armistice to the French delegation, led by General Charles Hunziker. Terms were described in 24 articles, but to summarize, they consisted of the following main points. France would be divided into two zones, one under German military occupation, and one to be left under nominal French rule. The occupied zone consisted of all of northern France and its entire Atlantic coast. Vichy France consisted of only the southeast two-fifths of France with access to some of the Mediterranean coastline. The remaining elements of the French army would be demobilized, and all heavy French armaments, weapons, munitions, and vehicles would be delivered to the German-occupied zone. German refugees in France must be returned to Germany, and all French prisoners in Germany will remain in Germany. All commercial vessels must remain in port, and those at sea must be recalled. The French Navy and Air Force would be demobilized and disarmed at locations specified and under the control of Germany or Italy. A portion of these forces could be used by Germany and Italy for coastal defenses, laying of mines, and other duties of home defense, as determined by Germany or Italy. Last but not least, French naval fleets in French colonial territories may remain in place for the proper defense of those territories. The French delegation found these terms especially harsh and rejected some of them initially. But General Keitel made it clear there would be no negotiating. Although there was a choice to be made, in the interest of the French people and the stabilization of the country, the French officials signed the armistice on 22nd June 1940. The seat of the new French government under occupation was in the city of Vichy. On paper, the Vichy government was self-governing, and it administered to all of France. But in reality, Vichy authority over the occupied zone was relegated to menial administrative functions and served at the pleasure of the Nazi regime. Following the signing of the armistice, Hitler had the site at Compiègne destroyed, and the train car and other monuments at the site were sent to Berlin. Hitler had the train car burned. Meanwhile, the Free French in England were under the leadership of General Charles de Gaulle, a former protégé of Pétain. De Gaulle was disgusted by the armistice and labeled Pétain as an anti-British defeatist. De Gaulle released his own statement from London, including this closing statement. "The destiny of the world is here. I, General de Gaulle, currently in London, invite the officers and the French soldiers who are located in British territory or who would come there, with their weapons or without their weapons, I invite the engineers and the special workers of armament industries who are located in British territory or who would come there to put themselves in contact with me. Whatever happens, the flame of the French resistance must not be extinguished and will not be extinguished." De Gaulle and Pétain continued to have a war of words over the next few years. With the armistice in place, the French National Assembly in Vichy voted to suspend the constitution of the Third Republic of France and created a new government, the Vichy regime, under the leadership of Marshal Philippe Pétain. The creation of Vichy France under tight German control was an immense and tricky problem for Winston Churchill. While the Vichy regime was officially neutral and non-belligerent, the formidable French fleet was now under control of the Nazi-dominated Vichy government. At any time, the fleet could fall into German or Italian hands, either voluntarily or by force. The size of the French fleet in North Africa was significant, with ships stationed at Mers El Kabir in French Algeria, Alexandria, Egypt, and Dakar, French West Africa. If the Germans were to gain access to this fleet, it would be an equal match to what had been a far superior British Royal Navy. While the terms of the armistice indicated the French Navy would be disarmed, Winston Churchill had no reason to trust Adolf Hitler. Since coming to power in 1933, the Führer had broken promise after promise, including the Treaty of Versailles, which formally ended World War I. Almost immediately, Hitler began raising an army, air force, and rebuilding a navy, and training them in secret. Naval ships and aircraft were built far beyond the limits first set by the Treaty of Versailles, and later the Anglo-German Naval Agreement of 1935. Which was also violated. In 1936, Hitler invaded the demilitarized zone of the Rhineland, then the Sudetenland, and finally Poland in 1939. Being the master manipulator, Hitler handed out promises with absolutely no intention of keeping them. Winston Churchill was not going to let Hitler get the better of him. He would need to address the problem of the French fleet, and quickly.
Hey everyone, Rich here. As much as I love telling you about maritime history, I also listen to a lot of podcasts, and I want to tell you about one that I personally love, American Elections, Wicked Game. There have been some wild elections in American history that broke all the rules of civility. There have been elections decided behind closed doors, elections that resulted in murder. And when you learn all this, and that we endured vicious, vile political contests over and over, you might come away feeling a little better about what's to come in 2024. From the host of American History Tellers, American Elections Wicked Game explores the entire history of presidential elections, from the unanimous and inevitable election of George Washington in 1789 to Donald Trump's surprise electoral victory in 2016 and his contested defeat in 2020. Follow American Elections Wicked Game wherever you're listening now, or to get early ad-free access to the entire series, bingeable now, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe to Into History at intohistory.com. Ahead of the armistice, Admiral Darlan ordered ships in French ports to sail to its colonial ports, and he repeatedly gave Churchill assurances that the French fleet would not be allowed to fall into German hands. But Churchill remained skeptical. The British Chiefs of Staff issued a memo at the end of June 1940, stating, "In the light of recent events, we can no longer place any faith in French assurances, nor could we be certain that any measures which we were given to understand the French would take to render their ships unserviceable before reaching French metropolitan ports would in fact be taken. Once the ships have reached French metropolitan ports, we are under no illusions as to the certainty that, sooner or later, the Germans will employ them against us." The day before the armistice was signed, British codebreakers intercepted a message from Admiral Darlan, ordering all French vessels in British ports to put to sea. To prevent this from happening, Operation Grasp was put into action at dawn on July 3rd. The goal of this mission was to board and seize all French ships currently in the ports of Portsmouth and Plymouth. The Royal Marines seized 5 submarines, including the largest submarine in the world at the time, the Surcouf, the battleships Paris and Corbet, destroyers Triumphant and Leopard, 8 torpedo boats, 3 mine layers, 16 submarine chasers, 7 motor torpedo boats, 98 minesweepers and patrol vessels, 42 tugs and harbor craft, and 20 trawlers. Some of the French sailors complied peacefully, but others forcefully resisted. The most significant incident occurred on the submarine Surcouf in Portsmouth. As the Royal Marines were preparing to board her, the French sailors attempted to seal off the hatches, but could not do so in time. The French officers then met their British counterparts in the officers' mess. The commanding British officer was Dennis Sprague, captain of the submarine HMS Thames, and he was accompanied by Lieutenant Patrick Griffiths of the HMS Rorqual. After a brief discussion, French commander Capitaine Paul Martin was permitted to disembark to confer with his commanding officer, Admiral Lucien Marius Gustave Caillol, who was on the battleship Paris, moored next to the Surcouf. The French sailors on the Surcouf then created a power failure in order to shred documents and destroy machinery in the dark to prevent them from falling into British hands. But this effort failed and the power was quickly switched back on. A bit perturbed, Sprague then ordered all the French officers to abandon ship immediately, threatening to shoot any that refused. Unafraid, the French officers replied, saying they only obeyed orders from their commander. After a brief hesitation by Sprague, a French officer pulled out a hidden pistol and quickly shot Sprague and Griffiths, mortally wounding them. A struggle ensued and a British seaman named Albert Webb killed French engineer Yves Daniel with a fixed bayonet before being shot and killed himself by the French boat's doctor. It was over quickly and the French realized there was no choice but to surrender their boat to the British. This was the first combat action between British and French soldiers since the Battle of Waterloo in 1815. French crew members who wished to stay in England and join the Free French were free to do so, while others were repatriated back to France. The same day as Operation Grasp was initiated, Operation Catapult was launched to deal with the French fleets in North Africa. British Force H, under the command of Admiral James Somerville, was dispatched to Mers El Kabir, near Oran in French Algeria, while Admiral William Cunningham was sent to Alexandria, Egypt.
British Force H was composed of the battlecruiser HMS Hood, the battleships HMS Valiant and Resolution, the aircraft carrier Ark Royal, with a number of cruisers and destroyers as escorts. The entire French fleet at Mers El Kabir was moored in the harbor. Somerville's orders from Admiral of the Fleet, Sir Dudley Pound, were to deliver an ultimatum to the commander at Mers El Kabir, Admiral Marcel Bruno Gensoul. The ultimatum read as follows. "It is impossible for us, your comrades up to now, to allow your fine ships to fall into the power of the German or Italian enemy. We are determined to fight on until the end, and if we win, as we think we shall never forget that France was our ally, that our interests are the same as hers, and that our common enemy is Germany. Should we conquer, we solemnly declare that we shall restore the greatness and territory of France. For this purpose, we must make sure that the best ships of the French Navy are not used against us by the common foe. In these circumstances, His Majesty's government have instructed me to demand that the French fleet, now at Mers El Kabir and Oran, shall act in accordance with one of the following alternatives. A. Sail with us and continue the fight until victory against the Germans and Italians. B. Sail with reduced crews under our control to a British port. The reduced crews would be repatriated at the earliest moment. If either of these courses is adopted by you, we will restore your ships to France at the conclusion of the war, or pay full compensation if they are damaged meanwhile. C. Alternatively, if you feel bound to stipulate that your ships should not be used against the Germans or Italians unless these break the armistice, then sail them with us with reduced crews to some French port in the West Indies, Martinique for instance, where they can be demilitarized to our satisfaction, or perhaps be entrusted to the United States and remain safe until the end of the war, the crews being repatriated. If you refuse these fair offers, I must with profound regret require you to sink your ships within 6 hours. Finally, failing the above, I have the orders from His Majesty's government to use whatever force may be necessary to prevent your ships from falling into German or Italian hands." Somerville consulted with Captain Cedric Holland, who was the former naval attaché to Paris. Holland was very familiar with the French government and the French people, and spoke fluent French. Somerville asked Holland to predict the French response to the ultimatum. After the discussion, Somerville sent a telegraph to London. "After talk with Holland and others, Vice Admiral Force H is impressed with the view that the use of force should be avoided at all costs. Holland considers offensive action on our part would alienate all French everywhere they are." After a few minutes, he received his reply. "Firm intention of His Majesty's government that if French will not accept any of your alternatives, they are to be destroyed." Churchill, additionally, wrote to Somerville, "You are charged with one of the most disagreeable tasks that a British admiral has ever been faced with, but we have complete confidence in you and rely on you to carry it out relentlessly." For his part, Somerville believed the use of force was a terrible mistake. Up until this very moment, the French had been their brothers in arms. Many of the naval officers were friendly to each other, making these orders highly distasteful. But Somerville was a professional, and he would follow orders. The French fleet at Mers El Kabir included the older battleships Provence and Bretagne, the modern battleships Dunkirk and Strasbourg, the seaplane tender Commandant Test, and 6 destroyers. At 0800 hours, Captain Holland was sent on the HMS Foxhound into the French port to deliver the ultimatum. Somerville thought it better to send Holland, as Holland personally knew Gensoul. Upon learning of the captain's arrival at Mers El Kabir, Admiral Gensoul was unimpressed, and in fact, he was insulted that a mere captain was sent to treat with him. He refused to meet with an officer of lower rank, and instead sent his aide, Lieutenant Bernard Dufay, who was also known to Holland. Holland gave the ultimatum to Dufay in a sealed envelope, which was then delivered to Gensoul. After receiving the ultimatum, Gensoul sent a reply to Holland, again through Dufay. Gensoul repeated his earlier stance, promising no French ships would be handed over to the Germans or Italians, adding, "Given the form and substance of the veritable ultimatum which has been sent to Admiral Gensoul, the French ships will defend themselves with force." Following the exchange, Jeansoul sent a message to Admiral Darlan, but was only able to reach his deputy. The message read, "An English force composed of 3 battleships, an aircraft carrier, cruisers, and destroyers before Oran has sent me an ultimatum. Sink your ships, 6-hour time limit, or we will constrain you or do so by force." My reply was, "French ships will answer force with force." No immediate reply from Darlan was received. Leading up to the armistice, Admiral Darlan himself promised Churchill on the 13th of July that he would never allow the fleet to fall to the Germans or Italians. A few days later, Darlan supported the armistice with Germany, which stipulated the use of some of the French fleet by Germany and Italy. On the 16th, Darlan refused to allow the French fleet to be removed to British ports, but on the 18th made a solemn promise again not to let the fleet fall into enemy hands. What was Somerville to make of this now? Was Darlan going to live up to his promise to Churchill? Or would he abide by the terms of the armistice? Jeansoul was furious over what he saw as an unacceptable ultimatum. He issued a communication to all the ships in the harbor. "English fleet has proposed unacceptable armistice. Be prepared to answer force with force." Around midday, he sent another message to Admiral Darlan, stating he intended to defend myself with force at the first cannon shot, which will have a result diametrically opposed to that desired by the British government. Jeansoul additionally ordered reinforcements to be sent from Toulon and Algiers, but the adept British codebreakers intercepted these orders and knew of these plans well in advance. As the 6-hour deadline was approaching, roughly 1:30 p.m., Somerville signaled to the French, demanding the terms be accepted or he would be forced to open fire. Jeansoul had finally received a message back from Admiral Darlan, instructing him to stand his ground. Jeansoul, stalling for time, requested and was granted a 2-hour extension to 3:30 p.m. Jeansoul then ordered 4 submarines in Oran to leave the port and stand by. Jeansoul then issued a statement to Somerville. "Admiral Jeansoul draws to the attention of Admiral Somerville the fact that the first shot fired against us would have the practical result of immediately turning the whole French fleet against Great Britain." Captain Holland at that time told his friend and French counterpart, Lieutenant Dufay, "Let me say to you, as one officer to another, that if I were in your place, my response would not have been different." As a precaution, Somerville ordered 6 swordfish and 3 Skua aircraft from the Ark Royal to drop magnetic mines across the mouth of the harbor in an attempt to box in the French fleet behind the breakwater. They were met by 5 French Curtiss H-75 fighters, which shot down 1 Skua, killing both crew members. But the British planes dropped 5 magnetic mines, partially closing off the harbor. Jeansoul, in response, ordered the submarine net that stretched across the entrance to the harbor to be cut, to allow for more space for his ships to escape, if necessary. On the British warships, tension was high. None of the sailors wished to fire on the French, including Admiral Somerville. Churchill's messages sent directly to Admiral Darlan were no longer receiving replies. The intentions of the French fleet were still unknown. As the already extended deadline approached, Jeansoul agreed to meet Captain Holland in person, aboard the French battleship Dunkirk in the harbor. Somerville, going against orders, provided another 2-hour extension for the talks to progress. Holland was brought on board the Dunkirk and was initially encouraged by the discussion. But according to Holland, there did not appear to be much urgency among the French. At 4:45 p.m., Somerville received a message from the Admiralty. "Settle matters quickly, or you will have reinforcements to deal with." With time running out, he offered the French one last opportunity and warning. He signaled again to the French, "If none of the British proposals are accepted by 17:30, it will be necessary to sink your ships." Somerville then gave the French a 4th option to the ultimatum: "Scuttle your ships where they lie." This message was also being sent nonstop via telegraph, but to no avail. The French commander responded with only what he promised before: French ships would not fall into enemy hands. At 5:25 p.m., a dejected Holland returned to the HMS Foxhound. Somerville waited 10 more minutes, hoping for a miracle. hoping the French would agree to the terms. With no other choice, at 5:55 p.m., Somerville ordered his ships to fire. The 15-inch guns of the older battleships HMS Valiant and Resolution opened up a barrage on the French ships, followed shortly after by a barrage from HMS Hood. Gensoul gave the order for his ships to return fire, untether, and leave the harbor. The Dunkirk and Provence immediately returned fire, but their rounds were falling short. The British sailors were intrigued with the red, yellow, and purple plumes of smoke rising from each round hitting the water. This was a clever method to help the gunners identify their own rounds to help find their range. The French ships were at a clear disadvantage. British Force H were roughly 5 miles away, moving at 17 knots, and positioned behind the high cliffs north of the port. The British ships could just make out the tops of the French fleet and fired their rounds up and over the cliffs. The French battleships and seaplane tender were moored to the outer jetty by their sterns, with their bows facing inward. To exit the harbor, the ships would need to navigate the narrow channel and avoid the magnetic mines dropped by the British planes. The first British salvos struck the jetty, blasting apart bits of concrete but causing little damage. Gensoul believed perhaps this was all that would come of it, a scare tactic, and he was calling the British bluff. But it was no bluff. The second salvo landed inside the jetty and included several near misses. But the third salvo from Force H found its target. The battleship Breton was struck numerous times, igniting a munitions magazine. The horribly mangled ship capsized and sank within just 8 minutes, killing 977 French sailors. The seaplane tender Commandant Test, adjacent to the Breton, suffered minor damage from the blast. The Strasbourg, Provence, and Dunkirk managed to untether and get underway. But the Dunkirk was immediately hit with multiple rounds, disabling her, except for just one engine. Captain M.J.M. Sequin managed to run the ship on shore as to not block the channel. Lacking a white flag, a tan flag was hoisted instead. The Provence was also hit and was sinking fast. Only quick action by her crew kept her afloat, and she was then grounded. The destroyer Mogador was making for the harbor exit when it was hit in its stern. The strike detonated its depth charges, blowing away the entire stern of the ship. Thanks to watertight bulkheads, the remaining portion of the ship remained afloat, and its commander skillfully guided his truncated ship and ran her aground on shore. Swordfish bombers and Skua fighters continued to roam the area, helping the gunners with spotting and positioning. They were met by French fighters and American-made Curtiss P-36 Hawks, a far superior fighter to the slower Skuas. Dogfights raged over the harbor while the Swordfish launched their torpedoes at the smoldering French fleet. Within just 10 minutes, the ships were on fire and the harbor shrouded in smoke. Admiral Gensoul messaged Somerville, "All my ships are out of action. I request you cease fire." Somerville replied starkly, "Unless I see your ship sinking, I shall open fire again." By this time, the Strasbourg, three destroyers, and one gunboat had managed to exit the harbor and were steaming at 28 knots to the northeast. Swordfish bombers from the HMS Ark Royal were launched to pursue the escaping ships, but their bombs missed their targets. Two of the planes were shot down, but their crews were rescued by the HMS Wrestler. HMS Hood gave chase as well, but Somerville was informed of four heavy cruisers, four light cruisers, and several destroyers en route to assist the Strasbourg. Somerville called off the pursuit, fearing he would be outnumbered by the time he was in range, and a night battle would be ill-advised. Another Swordfish attack from HMS Ark Royal was attempted at 6:55 p.m., but again failed to hit any of the escaping ships. The Strasbourg and its four escort ships reached Toulon on July 4th. The French gunboat Rigaud de Jean-Louis was inbound to Oran and approached HMS Hood at 7:33 p.m. It was intercepted by the light cruisers HMS Arethusa and Enterprise. Hood fired its 15-inch shells. Arethusa and Enterprise opened fire as well. The French gunboat responded with its 5.5-inch guns, but was soon hit and damaged by the Enterprise and withdrew. The following day, the Rigaud de Jean-Louis was intercepted by the submarine HMS Pandora while making for Algiers. The Pandora hit her with two torpedoes, and the French gunboat sank 6 miles off Cape Matafou. When the fighting was over at Mers El Kabir, 1,300 French sailors, marines, and officers were dead. British Force H returned to Gibraltar virtually unscathed. Admiral Somerville was privately shaken by what he was required to do, writing to his wife, "The truth is, my heart wasn't in it. I cursed the day I was landed with this appointment." The Vichy French government immediately ceased all diplomatic relations with the United Kingdom, calling the attack an act of treachery. The following day, another French message was intercepted from French Admiral Esteva. "The damage to the Dunkirk is minimal, and the ship will soon be repaired." Force H was then ordered to return to Mers El Kabir to finish off the French battleship. At 0620 on the 6th of July, six Swordfish of 820 Squadron from HMS Ark Royal swooped into the harbor and launched torpedoes at the grounded ship. Five torpedoes struck the Dunkirk, although one did not explode. The British planes were again met by French fighters. 20 minutes later, three more Swordfish from 810 Squadron arrived on the scene, escorted by six SCUAs. The Swordfish dropped their torpedoes, and two out of three found a target. The tug Terra Nueva had the misfortune of moving directly in the path of the torpedo meant for the Dunkirk. The tug was requisitioned by the French Navy to serve as an anti-submarine vessel, and therefore was carrying a load of depth charges. When the torpedo hit the helpless tug, the supply of depth charges was ignited, and the tug was annihilated. A second torpedo struck the Dunkirk amidships, putting her out of her misery. All of the British planes returned safely to the Ark Royal, but many of them suffered damage from dogfights and anti-aircraft fire. On the 5th of July, French planes bombed Gibraltar in retaliation, but did very little damage. Vichy French and Italian air attacks on Gibraltar would continue throughout the war. In Alexandria, Admiral Andrew Cunningham delivered the same ultimatum to French Admiral René-Émile Godefroy on July 3rd. Negotiations went on for several days, and on July 7th, an agreement of demobilization was made. British liaison in Cairo, Colonel Salisbury Jones, announced, "Thanks to the bonds of friendship between the British and French crews, demobilization of the French fleet at Alexandria has been carried out without difficulty and in a spirit of complete comprehension." Churchill made his statement abundantly and tragically clear. He would not allow French naval vessels to fall into the hands of the enemy. But there was more to be done. At this time, the United Kingdom and its colonial forces were essentially on their own to fight Germany on the Western Front. The Soviet Union had signed a pact with Germany and had invaded Eastern Poland, Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, and portions of Romania. In July of 1940, there was no suggestion of the Soviets ever joining the Allies, which would indeed happen the following year. And of course, the USA was still stubbornly neutral until the attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941.
Just before Halloween in 1985, a pipe bomb exploded in an office building in downtown Salt Lake City, killing a man and leaving the entire city on edge. As the smoke cleared and investigators began the search for answers, it became terrifyingly clear that this was just the beginning. Suddenly, looking for the culprit became a race against time. Hi, I'm Jeremy Schwartz, host of the new true crime history podcast, American Criminal. We take you inside the minds of some of our most notorious felons and outlaws, exploring the dark side to the American dream. In our latest season, the desperate hunt for a killer leads the authorities through the complicated world of historic document collectors, and eventually, right to the door of the Mormon Church. Listen to American Criminal, The Salt Lake City Bombings, wherever you get your podcasts. Or to get early ad-free access to the entire season first, plus hundreds of other ad-free history podcast episodes, subscribe at intohistory.com.
On the 8th of July, the still unfinished French battleship Jean Bart was attacked by British torpedo boats in Casablanca Harbor, causing significant damage. And at Dakar, the HMS Hermes launched Swordfish bombers to destroy the new French battleship Richelieu. One torpedo found its target, disabling the ship and flooding her hull. Satisfied with knocking out the battleship, the Hermes retreated. But other than a slightly submerged stern, some of Richelieu's guns and anti-aircraft artillery were still operational. While not seaworthy, it was a formidable gun platform. Churchill continued to push for approval to deal with the Vichy fleet at Dakar, and on the 27th of August received approval to launch Operation Menace. The operation included Free French forces, as de Gaulle was anxious to participate in the action and determine the loyalties of French West Africa. The expedition officially began on the 30th of August, with ships leaving Scapa Flow, Liverpool, and the Clyde, plus the Ark Royal detached from Gibraltar. Dakar was an important strategic port on the coast of French West Africa, but also the location of the gold reserves of the Bank of France and that of the exiled Polish government. On the 5th of September, the Vichy government received permission from the German Armistice Council to send 6 vessels from Toulon in order to access food supplies that were crucial for mainland France. This was dubbed Force Y by the Vichy government, under the command of Admiral Barague. But the British Consul General at Tangier discovered this plan and sent a cable to Admiral Sir Dudley North, flag officer commanding the North Atlantic Station at Gibraltar. The cable read, "French squadron may try to pass straits proceeding westward for unknown destination. This attempt may be timed to take place within the next 72 hours. The following day, a naval liaison in Madrid informed the British command in Gibraltar of 6 ships leaving Toulon. On the 11th of September, the 6 Vichy ships approached Gibraltar. The British command radioed, "What ships?" Barague sent his response, "French cruisers and destroyers." After confirming the names of the vessels as Gloire, Georges Laigue, Montcalm, Fantasque, Audacieux, and Malin, the Vichy ships were permitted to pass through the strait unscathed. Churchill and the Admiralty were furious with North for allowing these ships to escape in the midst of Operation Menace. The HMS Renown and all of the destroyers were immediately dispatched to chase down the Vichy fleet. Their orders were to prevent them from reaching Dakar and to force them into port at Casablanca. As it turned out, Fleet Y had already arrived at Casablanca on their own accord. Somerville ordered a patrol to prevent the ships from escaping, but under the cover of night, Barague easily slipped past the sparse blockade, and the chase was on. Barague knew the 3 destroyers did not have sufficient fuel to reach Dakar, and ordered them back to Casablanca. The battlecruiser HMAS Australia nearly collided with the Vichy cruiser Gloire in low visibility, just barely averting a catastrophe. The Gloire was having mechanical problems, and its commander agreed to be escorted back to Casablanca. The 2 other Vichy cruisers, Montcalm and Georges Laigue, escaped the pursuit and arrived in Dakar on the 14th of September. North was criticized harshly and publicly. However, North was only following standing orders. On the 12th of July, over a month before, he received orders that no further action should be taken against Vichy ships. Churchill himself repeated this order in a speech to the House of Commons on the 14th of July. In fact, Admiral North was not yet informed of Operation Menace. Finally, it was Admiral Somerville who was in command of Force H at Gibraltar, and North expected any orders for action would be placed directly from Somerville. Admiral North was in troubled waters with Churchill already. Following the destruction of the French fleet at Mers El Kabir, North sent a letter criticizing the attack. This letter did not go over well with Churchill or First Lord of the Admiralty, A.V. Alexander, and both of them wished to replace North immediately. However, First Sea Lord Sir Dudley Pound stepped in, and North received just a formal reprimand. But now, from the perspective in London, North had allowed French reinforcements to escape into the Atlantic to reinforce Dakar. This was a blow to Churchill in Operation Menace. The arrival of the additional cruisers at Dakar, along with reports of bitter anti-British sentiment in Dakar, were not promising. Churchill later stated, "This chapter of accidents sealed the fate of the Franco-British expedition to Dakar. I had no doubt whatever that the enterprise should be abandoned. The whole scheme of a bloodless landing and occupation by General de Gaulle seemed to me ruined by the arrival of the French squadron, probably carrying reinforcements, good gunners, and bitter-minded Vichy officers. But Admiral Cunningham and General de Gaulle lobbied Churchill to continue the operation, and Churchill was persuaded. Operation Menace would go on as planned. On the French side, Admiral Darlan was furious at Borag for dividing his fleet and allowing 4 out of 6 vessels to be bottled up at Casablanca, saying Borag simply ran away rather than fight. But Borag knew better than to engage with a superior force, and had standing orders not to do so. Darlan relieved Borag of command, but later realized he was wrong about the situation, and then promoted Borag. The Anglo-French naval force was led by Vice Admiral John Cunningham, and included the aircraft carrier HMS Ark Royal, the battleships HMS Barham and HMS Resolution, 5 cruisers, and 11 destroyers. The meager Free French contribution consisted of 3 sloops and 2 armed trawlers. Additional ships carried 4,300 troops from the 101st Brigade of the Royal Marines and 3,600 Free French troops. In opposition, the French forces at Dakar were commanded by Admiral Pierre-François Boisson and consisted of the Richelieu, the cruisers George Legge and Montcalm, 3 submarines, 3 destroyers, and several smaller vessels. Boisson also had American-made and formidable Glenn Martin bombers and Curtis Hawk 75A fighters. The primary objective of Operation Menace was to capture Dakar and its valuable port and prevent it from becoming a base for German naval operations. Charles de Gaulle wished to bring French West Africa under Free French control. On the 23rd of September, the Anglo-French forces had gathered off the coast of Dakar. The preparations for Operation Menace listed 3 possible outcomes: happy, sticky, or nasty. For the outcome to be happy, the Vichy forces at Dakar would see the gathering fleet bearing down on them and willingly surrender and join the Free French and Charles de Gaulle. Resistance from the Vichy would result in it being sticky, and fierce resistance requiring a ground invasion would be rather nasty. Very heavy fog eliminated any hope for happy. With visibility at roughly 4,000 meters, the Dakar forces could not even see the Anglo-French fleet. Likewise, the gunners of Force H could not see the ships at Dakar or the shore batteries. At best, it would be sticky. British planes of the Fleet Air Arm dropped propaganda leaflets over Dakar, and 2 French Caudron C-272 aircraft and a British Swordfish took off from the carrier Ark Royal, carrying 3 of de Gaulle's emissaries, landing at Oakham Aerodrome. Rear Admiral Marcel Landrau, who was in command of the naval forces of Vichy French West Africa, guessed where the emissaries would land and ordered their immediate arrest. The men were found with Free French propaganda and a list of de Gaulle loyalists living in Dakar, who were all promptly rounded up and arrested. Additional representatives of the Free French arrived at the harbor in a small boat, wishing to discuss terms. When Vichy French guns fired on them, the vessel quickly retreated. The sight of British planes over Dakar prompted Landrau to order his guns to fire at the enemy and for his ships to build up steam. Admiral Cunningham sent a radio message to Dakar. "If fire continues on my ships, I shall regretfully be compelled to return it." He received a short and curt reply. "If you do not wish me to fire, please remove yourself more than 20 miles from Dakar." Still, Cunningham did not return fire for over an hour. The cruiser HMS Cumberland was hit and damaged, forcing her to leave the battle. And the destroyer HMS Foresight was also struck, but was able to continue. The French submarine Percy slipped out of the harbor and fired 2 torpedoes at the Anglo-French fleet before being shelled and depth-charged by the Foresight and Inglefield. The Percy was sunk, but most of its crew were rescued. A ground invasion, with Charles de Gaulle included, was attempted 13 miles to the south of Dakar at Rufisque, but French planes spotted the invasion vessels. The heavy destroyer Audacieux slipped away from Dakar and headed for Rufisque, but was intercepted by HMAS Australia. After warnings to turn back were ignored, the Australia fired its 8-inch guns, setting the Audacieux ablaze and causing her to be beached. Three Vichy cruisers came after the Audacio, but returned to Dakar after failing to find the landing force in the fog and learning the fate of the Audacio. But the ground invasion was repulsed by Vichy shore batteries. The embittered Vichy forces in French West Africa were not going to side with de Gaulle, as was hoped, and the attempted invasion was short-lived. Dejected, de Gaulle abandoned the invasion, saying he did not want to shed the blood of Frenchmen for Frenchmen. Throughout the first day of the battle, the heavy fog still hampered the bombardment, with both sides essentially firing blindly. At 11:45 p.m., Admiral Cunningham sent an ultimatum to Dakar. The base would not be permitted to be handed over to the Axis powers, and terms of surrender must be accepted by 6 o'clock a.m. The response from Admiral Boisson was simple. France has entrusted me with Dakar. I shall defend Dakar to the end. The battle resumed on the 24th of September after receiving Boisson's response. Skua bombers and Swordfish fighters from the Ark Royal were launched and attacked the still formidable Richelieu and Vichy shore defenses. The attack did little damage, and 8 British planes were shot down by the Vichy's Curtis Hawk fighters and anti-aircraft fire from the Richelieu. However, as the Richelieu was returning fire, its number 2 turret failed and exploded, leaving only its number 1 turret functional. The Richelieu was also hit by 2 15-inch shells from the HMS Barham, causing damage but still not disabling her. The Vichy submarine Ajax attempted an attack but was detected by the HMS Barham and Fortune, which launched depth charges. The Ajax was badly damaged, causing her to surface and to be scuttled. Most of its crew were rescued by HMS Fortune. Further dogfights ensued over Dakar, with the superior Vichy Curtis Hawk aircraft largely getting the best of the Swordfish and Skuas. On the 25th, the third day of the battle, the fog had lifted. As the Allied ships were lining up to resume their bombardment, the Vichy submarine Beauvaisier surfaced and launched its torpedoes, striking the HMS Resolution and causing significant damage. Cunningham then ordered the fleet to withdraw out of range of coastal defenses. After receiving the news from Cunningham, Winston Churchill and his cabinet called off the attack on Dakar. He sent a telegraph stating, "On all the information now before us, including damage to Resolution, we have decided that the enterprise against Dakar should be abandoned." Thus ended Operation Menace. It has since been referred to as the debacle at Dakar. During the battle, the Vichy French Air Force dropped nearly 500 bombs on the British base at Gibraltar, causing significant damage, starting fires, killing several civilians, and sinking an armed trawler. British planes did not engage during the attacks on Gibraltar. The worst damage suffered during the Battle of Dakar was to Charles de Gaulle. Up until this point, de Gaulle and the British were hopeful and confident of French colonial forces joining the Free French. The failure of Operation Menace was a rebuke to de Gaulle and damaged his reputation as the leader of the Free French and shook his confidence, at least for the time being. On the 8th of October in Gibraltar, Admiral Somerville expressed his frustration in a letter to his wife, writing, "The Admiralty won't keep us informed and in the picture. They keep us guessing, and if we guess wrong, then they want to have our blood. It looks to me as if they are trying to put the blame for this disastrous Dakar business on Dudley and me. Well, I have a mouthful to say on the subject." Sir Dudley North was relieved of command later that month. Vichy France continued its resistance against the Allies and became full collaborators with the Axis powers under Pétain, even contributing to the horrors of the Holocaust. Historian Robert Paxton, author of Vichy France, Old Guard and New Order, 1940-1944, writes, "The Vichy French government participated willingly in the deportations and did most of the arresting. The arrests of Jewish citizens in France often involved separating families from their children, sometimes in broad daylight, and it had a very powerful effect on public opinion and began to turn opinion against Pétain." In November of 1942, the Allies invaded North Africa during Operation Torch. The Vichy forces were defeated, and they surrendered to the Allies. Germany then moved on to occupy all of France, except for a small area occupied by Italy near the French Alps. The Vichy government officially maintained jurisdiction over mainland France, but as a full puppet state of Nazi Germany. The Vichy government in France ended permanently after the liberation of Paris in September of 1944. By then, Pétain and other Vichy leaders had been whisked away to Germany to form a French puppet government in exile. Pétain and others were captured by the Allies in 1945 and put on trial in France. Marshal Pétain was convicted of treason and sentenced to death. However, due to his advanced age, Charles de Gaulle commuted his sentence to life in prison. Philippe Pétain died at a private home after suffering from dementia in 1951 at the age of 95. Sir Dudley North retired from the Royal Navy in 1941. He then served in the Home Guard as flag officer in charge at Great Yarmouth in 1943 and was named a commander of the Legion of Merit by the United States government. North fought to clear his name regarding the failure to contain the French fleet, and finally in 1957, he was partially exonerated. Sir Dudley North died in 1961 at age 79. Admiral James Somerville served throughout the remainder of World War II and was named Commander-in-Chief of the Eastern Fleet in 1942 and Admiral of the Fleet in 1945. Admiral François Darlan was assassinated on December 24, 1942 by an anti-Vichy pro-monarchist named Ferdinand Bonnier de La Chapelle. La Chapelle was tried the following day and executed by firing squad. General Charles de Gaulle was named the chairman of the Provisional Government of the French Republic following the war, and served in that role until 1946. He later served as Prime Minister of France in 1958, and then as President of France from 1959 to 1969. Charles de Gaulle died in 1970 at age 79. Winston Churchill's term as Prime Minister ended in 1945, but he again served Crown and Country as Prime Minister from 1951 to 1955. Winston Churchill died in 1965 at age 90. That is going to do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs is written, edited, and produced by me, Rich Napolitano. You can follow Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs on social media at ShipwrecksPod. I am pleased to now offer official merchandise. Go to shipwrecksandseadogs.com and click Merch. Check it out. There are multiple designs in a variety of colors, men and women's. You'll be supporting the show and getting something nice for yourself or someone else. Also, please remember a great way to support the show is to leave a rating and review and to tell a friend. Original theme music for Shipwrecks and Sea Dogs is by Sean Siegfried, and you can follow him on YouTube at Sean Secret or on the web at sean.siegfried.se. Please join me again in 2 weeks for another new episode. Until then, don't forget to wear your life jackets.